Do you want to know more about when cash value or permanent life insurance might be right for you, and also learn what to look out for when getting sold such types of insurance? If so, you're in for a treat, because I'll be talking about these things with special guest Kevin Lau in this, the 77th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
All right, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. We got a special treat for you today. Also, first time doing this process where I am recording with someone else with me. I have Kevin Lau. Hi, Kevin.
Andy, how you doing?
I'm super. Thanks for coming on. So Kevin Lau is the owner of Imagine Financial Security, based out of Jacksonville, Florida. He has a experience at a few different places, large companies that really help the discussion of today's topic, which we want to get into insurance, namely life insurance. And it'll be twofold. One is understanding when it makes sense, what type's good, what type isn't for you and your particular needs, and then also kind of what to look out for in the sales process and the pitch, because unfortunately, for as valuable and beneficial as insurance products are, they're often not sold in the best of ways, or such is my experience. So I thought Kevin would be a great guest to have, because he's lived it both sides, from working at one of the big places, insurance places, to a couple of them, to now being his own independent, the only firm, where he does not directly sell insurance, but thoroughly understands it and realizes the importance of it, and can present it well and analyze it well for folks who really need it, to help them figure out what is the best insurance for them. So Kevin, hope I framed that out well for now.
Spot on, Andy. Yeah.
Awesome. So let me give you, for those of you that listen to this show or follow me for a while, I think you probably have pieced together my background, but let me just kind of set up where this particular episode came from, and why I was thankful to that Kevin said yes to joining when I reached out. So my background, just to recap, I graduated college in 2000, went to school for finance, and wanted to be what I thought a financial advisor was. I didn't really know what it was. I just wanted to help people make decisions about money, basically, and their, you know, personal finances. While on campus, I went to job fairs and, you know, student services, and there was multiple large household name brokerages, banks, and insurance companies that were recruiting on campus. And I interviewed for a few that were called financial advisor in title, one of which was a really large national insurance company that everyone here has heard of or would easily recognize, and had multiple rounds of interviews with them. And I think it's probably four rounds, maybe five. And in each one, I increasingly realized it wasn't really advising. It was sales. It was 100% commission. There was no base salary. It was initially just selling insurance, with the eventual goal and expectation that you get other licensees to sell other products like mutual funds and investments. And heavy sales culture. So, you know, between people I met with, one guy called it dialing for dollars. So, you know, you're going to make 100 cold calls a day or whatever. Every one or two will eventually pan out to a purchase. So it's just a numbers game, right? Another guy I met with was a few years out of school. I've been doing the job for a while, and was telling me kind of off the cuff that, like, we sell just term insurance for the most part. Well, it's relatively easy to sell term insurance, but the quote unquote holy grail is getting someone to buy a whole life policy, because the commissions are often bigger on them. And there's a handful of things like that where I was like, oh, this doesn't feel like advising. It's just selling. And I had a similar experience at another place, really large, well-known multi-level marketing structure, where part of the incentive is you in effect get people under you and your organization, if you will, to sell things, where every commission they get, you get a small cut of it. So it's focus of that company is as much like building your own sales practice as it is actually selling product to people. But again, just heavily sales focused. So got disenfranchised and turned off by that, and gave up on the idea of being an advisor, and stumbled into corporate investments and risk management, and spent 19 years doing that. Along the way, learned a lot about investments and insurance, having worked at an insurance company for a few years, albeit not selling, but kind of behind the scenes doing some of the product structuring, investment management. So developed a deeper understanding of insurance products. And then bringing it full circle, when I left the corporate world to start my own retirement planning firm in 2019, I've always realized the importance of insurance, but now saw firsthand in the retirement planning circles I was running in, how a lot of insurance products are just inappropriately sold, you know, sold on fear, sold with some misrepresentations, or really massaging the message and kind of leaving out certain things and speaking half-truths. And so I saw firsthand how the sales culture has, not everyone, but in a lot of cases, translates to they're just out there trying to push product and kind of saying and doing whatever they need to say and do to get product to people. And it's a huge disservice because many insurance products, whether it's life insurance, annuities, or the property and casualty stuff like homeowners and, you know, super important and necessary. It's just understanding the right kind, what is, what isn't good for you, what you should, what you shouldn't get, et cetera. So I've been vocal in lots of public places about insurance sales processes. Now, people misinterpret that to think I hate insurance or I rag on insurance. I don't. It's a process through which it's often sold is what I take issue with. And I've, for better or worse, have kind of become known as the guy who seems to have a chip on his shoulder about insurance sales, which to some extent is probably true. And so a good friend of mine said, hey, I got a great idea for a podcast. Why don't you find someone who worked in insurance and can sort of speak to the process firsthand and do two things with it. One is sort of help consumers know when they're getting pitched, know how to sort of sift through some of the messaging and you know, sales process in front of them, but also understand the products a little more, namely life insurance. There's a lot of different ways it can get structured, lots of different types, to better understand the fundamentals of life insurance and what policies may or may not be good for them. So then I started looking around for who I think would be a good fit. And Kevin, I know you already, and you came to mind because you worked at one of these really big places. You worked at really big places. And now you're kind of more or less doing the same thing I am with this sort of retiree planning, fee only, not selling insurance, but realizing the importance of it, et cetera. So that's that long-winded way of sort of setting up why we're doing this episode and why you're here. So thank you again, Kevin, for taking the time to be on.
Yeah, and Andy, thanks for being that guy, because I couldn't be that guy. You must have some thick skin, because I know you take a lot of jabs on like social media comments, and it's just, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, you know, sort of bringing light to this particular topic, because insurance, like you said, it does fit really, really well with a lot of plans. But I think a lot of consumers have such a bad taste in their mouth because of maybe how they were pitched when they were younger, or maybe, you know, they have a friend or a parent that were pitched, you know, in the wrong way. And automatically they dismiss the product as part of their plan, which I think is also a disservice to consumers. So I'm super excited to unpack this. And speaking of the career fairs, that's exactly how I was recruited, you know, in 2008. You know, I was a graduating senior at the University of South Carolina. You remember 2008, 2009, the Great Recession, not a great time to graduate with a finance degree, right? But I was on this career fair, and a couple of friends of mine were like, hey, you need to go and talk to this table. I think you would be good at what they're talking about. So they ended up convincing me to go to this happy hour that evening. And I think there were like around 50 of us there, but like literally the thing that resonated with me, I don't know why at the time, like I was 21 at the time, but you know, the director of the region, you know, he sort of got up and said, hey, there's 50 of you here today. In 5 years, there's going to be one of you. And I don't even know what they were doing at the time. I was just like, I want to sign up. I want to do that. No one else is hiring. I'll work for all commissions. It's fine. But I'm so thankful I did that, because A, I learned a lot about the financial services industry, and B, I met my wife. So that, you know, that's that.
Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So can you just step back, maybe recap a little bit? So you already said you graduated in 2008, not the best time to be entering the job force, but and went to one of these large places. Can you just sort of step through from that up until now, and you know, what you do and how you got there?
Yeah, I mean, I think exactly what you're talking about. You know, sort of this, the sales culture is really what I was kind of raised in with financial services. I loved the idea of helping people. You know, I think that was sort of the bottom line of like figuring out a way to make an impact on people's lives, you know, using my finance degree. You know, and so like I didn't know at that point in time, like, hey, this is going to be where I am forever. But I was definitely all in on the career, you know, and I had some really good mentors at the time that, you know, sort of taught me the sales process and the business development process. Like you said, doing a lot of cold calling, you know, getting hung up a lot, people saying really nasty things when I called them. So just going through that whole process was very humbling. But I learned a lot. And, you know, I think, you know, so, you know, particularly on how insurance is positioned in the plan, you know, because I worked at one of the big mutual companies, you know, how it's positioned in the plan and then how the product is designed the right way. And also how you could not design it the right way and not necessarily do what's in the best interest of the client. I learned a lot of that. And I spent about 6 years there. But I think really the turning point for me was around year three. I did my certified financial planner designation. And I think the head of the program there at Georgetown was kind of changed my mindset on like how I was doing what I was doing, you know, in terms of sitting on the same side of the table as the client. And if the only way for the client to hire you was by buying an insurance product, is that really the best thing to do? You know what I mean? Is that really the best way to service clients? And really at that point in time, I was 25, you know, I was like, no, this is not the best way to do it. You know, I had done fairly well. I was a decent producer. My first 6 months were not very good. I think I wrote 5 policies, 3 on myself. I bought a long-term care insurance policy on myself, a life policy and a disability policy so I could go to Costa Rica, and then 2 on my parents. I didn't sell a lot of product, you know, sell a lot of policies my first 6 months. But after that, I started to write a lot of business and I was doing well financially. But I think that point in time, year 3, is when I sort of began to pivot and look at other opportunities and look at other ways to do it and discover the XY Planning Network and the fee only route. And so I, even at that point in time, this was 2013, 14, I sort of had this vision of like being independent, you know, sort of doing this on my own to sit on the same side of the table as clients that I serve. But like I said, it was an amazing experience overall. Met some awesome people. And most importantly, you know, met my wife, and now we have 3 boys. So we're having fun.
That's fantastic. All right. Thanks, Kevin. That was a great recap of your background. Much appreciate it. So I had another thought about what rubs me the wrong way with sales process, especially as it relates to financial services and retirement planning, or not just retirement, but whatever. And how complicated products often are and how much consumers don't know what they don't know. So not a perfect example, but when you go to buy a car, you go to a car dealer, you know the people you're sitting across the table from are there to sell you a car. Even if they call themselves transportation advisors instead of car salesperson, like, you know their job to sell you a car, right? They're not going to say, you know what, maybe it'd be best if you use the bus instead of buy a car or walk or get a good bike, right? And so people understand that. And they know going into it what to expect. And to the extent they need to get their sort of antenna and defenses up, they do. When it comes to financial services, whether it's someone just looking to manage investments, whether it's someone just looking to sell the latest, greatest mutual fund, or someone looking to sell an insurance product, consumers don't know what they don't know. No. Most people probably assume an advisor is an advisor because he or she calls himself that. They're all the same thing. They're there to give me advice. Presumably as like unbiased and accurate as it could be. Yep. But no, what they sell, what product or service they sell, how they're compensated, that greatly dictates it. And if someone calls himself or herself an advisor, when behind the scenes, all they do is really just sell a certain product.
Yep.
Consumer doesn't know that. And especially if it's a really complicated product, it's easy to sort of distort and spin and explain that product as if it does everything this client needs, when in reality, there could be dozens of other options that could suit things better. So that's why I sort of feel like we need to defend the average consumer who doesn't know when they're getting sold or who they're sitting in front of, whereas they do when they go to buy a car. Again, it's far from a great analogy, but that's why I feel so strong about kind of educating and telling people, watch out for this or be aware of that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I mean, literally one of the worst feelings that I had, like early on in my, let's say year one or year two, I didn't know about the products I was selling. You know, I didn't understand them. I was 22 at the time. So what I did, you know, like other smart, successful advisors were doing, they would bring in the veterans, you know, kind of bring in the closers to actually meet with the prospect. So I would spend the first meeting myself doing an interview with the client in the discovery meeting, learning about their goals, their objectives, and you know, how we can, you know, talking about ways we can help them get to point A to point B, essentially financial independence. And sort of they would leave that meeting like so excited about all the different ways, things that we talked about, educating their kids and retirement, et cetera. But then the next meeting, it was like this feeling of like, okay, now we need to, you know, fit this round peg in a square hole, or a square peg in a round hole type of thing. We need to figure out a way to connect this insurance product to this client now. And it just felt very disingenuous. And like, I think even the bigger challenge today, you know, a lot of these big insurance companies are allowing advisors to go out and create DBAs, you know, doing business as, you know, XYZ wealth management or, you know, ABC financial planning. And I think that's even further distorting, like from a consumer's perspective, like how was this person actually compensated? And that was a big draw, like learning about this fee only space and this flat fee space. It was a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. So maybe let's start. Again, I want this topic to be twofold. One is like educating about insurance, different kinds, you know, what works here, what doesn't. And then maybe talk about some of like the sales things you learned and what you would advise people to sort of be aware of or look out for. So, and to the extent you can, let's keep this more so focused on like the retiree, pre-retiree crowd, since that is sort of the folks probably listening to retirement planning education. Not to say insurance isn't important for, you know, people of all stages of life, but so maybe just start, I don't know, basics of life insurance and go from there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the general like life insurance, you know, the way I would explain it to someone who has no idea about how life insurance works is there's so many different flavors out there. Don't focus on all the different flavors or the bells and whistles to start with, you know, just, you know, purely like, do you have a need for life insurance, or do you have a desire to own life insurance? And life insurance provides a death benefit tax-free to your beneficiaries, your named beneficiaries. So that could be your spouse, it could be your children or your grandchildren. And that's really the most important thing about life insurance is like, if you have a need or a want for insurance, how much insurance do you need or want, right? And, you know, you can kind of go with the CFP board, you know, like, hey, own 10 to 16 times your gross income, or at least that's what they told us, you know, when I was doing the CFP back in 2012, you know, 10 to 16 times your gross income. If you're, let's say you're making $200,000 a year, that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million to 3 million roughly, you know, of coverage that you may need. That is the most important thing. And, you know, once you figure that number out, then you want to work with someone like yourself, Andy, or someone who is objective that can coach you through on the different types of products. But if we want to talk about the two primary types, you have term and permanent, right? You have insurance that's going to expire at a set date. So oftentimes these policies may expire in 10 years or in 20 years or 30 or at a certain age. Maybe it's age 75 or age 80. And at that point in time, the insurance goes away. So your lease is up and you don't have the coverage anymore. Whereas permanent insurance is a policy you can own for your entire lifetime. So if there's a want or need to have insurance coverage in your retirement years, you most likely want to own that coverage in some form of permanent insurance. And that's where it gets really, really complicated, because there are, I don't know, a handful, maybe even more of kind of your traditional types of permanent policies, all with different spins and flavors in them and different carriers that go in and out of the industry. And so that's where it can get really confusing for consumers. And oftentimes that's where people are like, I give up. I'm just going to buy term and invest the difference and call it a day. And I think that's where the opportunity is for those people that actually may want or need some form of permanent insurance in retirement.
That's a great segue. In what circumstances should someone maybe consider permanent insurance? So term, like you said, lasts for a certain time. You buy this policy for 20 years, let's say. If you die within those 20 years, your beneficiaries get paid out whatever the payout is.
Yep.
If you live beyond the 20 years, that's it. Policy's over. There's no other like residual asset or terminal value. It's just you're done. You're done paying premiums, but you're no longer covered if you die. Whereas permanent insurance is meant to last your entire life. And, you know, as long as you keep paying, keep it quote unquote in force, abide by the rules of the contract, you will have this death benefit that lasts as long as you do. How do people even start to consider, you know, typical retiree, someone 60-ish, maybe they already stopped working, maybe they didn't, but how do they even begin to assess whether or not they want or need permanent life insurance?
Yeah, one of the most popular, you know, concepts that people think about is estate taxes, right? And it's not as relevant now because the estate exemption is what, over 12.9 million per person. So if you die with an estate underneath that amount, there's no federal estate taxes due. There could be state estate taxes due, but there's no federal. So if you're married, multiply that number by two. And as you can see, a lot of people are under that threshold. But back in the day, I mean, back in, what was it, 2008, the exemption was around $1 million. So when I was first starting in the industry, this was a topic that we talked about with a lot of households of, hey, if you pass away now, if you add up your home and, you know, your 401k, your taxable brokerage account, and you have $5 million, well, you're now $4 million over that estate tax exemption. So you're going to have to pay federal estate taxes or your estate will. And so owning a form of permanent life insurance, most of the time in some kind of irrevocable trust and irrevocable life insurance trust, was kind of the go-to strategy for permanent insurance for someone who may need permanent insurance, pay those estate taxes. Because, you know, especially for business owners, if they passed away and, you know, they wanted their children to inherit that company, but the valuation of the business, there's not liquidity, but it's valued at $10 million. Well, where are they going to get the cash to pay that estate taxes? So it often results in them having to do a fire sale of assets to pay the estate tax. So that has kind of faded away because of how high the exemption is, but that could change. I mean, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and what that sunsetting at the end of 2025. You know, so I think more people are going to be over that estate tax threshold, and they may want or need permanent life insurance to help preserve their assets for the next generation. Another common scenario is a special needs situation where you have a child or an adult child with special needs that's going to need care for a very long time. It's not going to go away. And so, you know, there may be a desire to have a special needs trust to kind of preserve some of their other federal benefits that they may get. And funding that special needs trust with life insurance is also a very effective way, you know, to go about doing it. I think, though, in practicality, like working with kind of your traditional age 55, 60 year old who's approaching retirement, the ones that I serve that have permanent life insurance right now, it kind of establishes this as, like, I like to call it a legacy floor. Like, no matter what happens with their investments, like, you know, if the market tanks or we go through a depression or, you know, something like 08-09, you know, and their investments go down by, let's say, 25-30%, hopefully that doesn't happen again. But if it did, they have this like sense of security knowing that their legacy goals are covered. Like, hey, you know, I want to preserve my principal to, you know, my children or my grandchildren, and I want to make sure that legacy is taken care of. They may not have an estate tax problem. They may not have a special needs trust, a need for a special needs trust, but they just had this goal of leaving a legacy to their family. Like, that was part of their retirement goal. And I think having life insurance as sort of the baseline has helped them more psychologically than anything else, because, like, you and I know, we can run Monte Carlos all day long and run the projections and tell them, hey, you're not only going to preserve your principal, but you're going to actually grow your wealth by inflation. Like, hey, how does that sound? People are still worried about what could potentially happen. You know, they lived through the 70s and 80s. They lived through the tech boom and bust. They lived through the Great Recession and, you know, most recently, this recent bear market. So I think the legacy floor for kind of even your folks that don't have a need to pay estate taxes, it really resonates. You know, I think of this client that I have that I'm working with. She's 80 years old, and, you know, she has a son who, you know, lost his wife, and he has two youngish sons. And he's not making the income he would need to support them through college. She has a legacy goal. You know, she doesn't have an estate tax problem, but she has a legacy goal. And it just gives her that peace of mind that she has this roughly $1 million death benefit that's going to be passed on to Ian in the grandkids, regardless of what happens with her IRA or brokerage accounts.
Yeah, that's a great point. The legacy floor. Maybe it's just coincidence, but most of the folks I work with and have come across don't have particularly strong legacy desires. Even if they do have kids, grandkids, it's like, I want to enjoy what I have. Whatever's left, of course, will go to my kids, grandkids. But otherwise, like, I want to enjoy this money. But for the folks that do have a strong desire to leave at least a certain amount, this is exactly where life insurance comes into play. This is what it was made to do, more or less, right?
Yep.
So. That's a great point.
Exactly. It's all, you know, the death benefit is the primary purpose, you know, and I think we're going to get into some of the mechanics about like how it's sold as a savings vehicle, et cetera. The primary purpose of life insurance is that death benefit and the tax-free nature of that death benefit. And whether you buy term or permanent is going to be based on your personal preferences, your personal goals and objectives. And then I would also even further say that, if you do have a younger listener, let's say they're in their 40s or early 50s, that's still a ways out from retirement, you know, they may want permanent insurance down the road. It's important to have a term policy that's convertible to a permanent policy they want to own, you know, because some carriers that offer term are not the carriers you want to have permanent insurance with. And if you just kind of go and shop at, you know, whatever your XYZ brokerage firm that sells a bunch of insurance policies, that may not be the policy you want converted into a permanent policy. So it's just, you know, kind of like a little side note of like, even if it's not a great fit today or not something you want today, but you think it could be down the road, you may want to own a term policy that's convertible into the right product that you want to own.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So maybe just pause and recap for the typical retiree, pre-retiree. So far, it sounds like there's three pretty obvious scenarios where whole life, permanent life, I don't want to use the term whole life, that has its own meaning, right? But permanent life, one would be to pay estate taxes. Perfect example is you, large majority of your net worth is in a business. It's not liquid. You can't just freely sell the business. You die. Your estate now is whatever, $40 million, the value of this business. You have a big estate tax that your estate has to pay. You don't have the cash, right? So permanent life insurance policy, boom, there you go, tax-free cash. So that's one. Two is like special needs trust. You have a child who will always need support, you know, financial support throughout his or her life. You can buy a policy that regardless how long you live, when you eventually die, you know, you're presumably caring for that child physically and financially while you're alive. You die, you can have the payout from a life insurance policy go to help fund the child's needs. Now, we're not lawyers, but ideally it's usually best suited to go into a special needs trust, right? For a host of reasons.
Yep.
And then third is simply legacy. If you want to ensure you have at least X amount left to go to your heirs when you die, life insurance is one of the best, if not the best, ways to tax efficiently transfer wealth and ensure a legacy.
Yeah.
Cool.
No, spot on. I think with the legacy floor, you mentioned like a lot of your clients, like they want to maximize their spending in retirement. Absolutely. That's what they want to do. But a lot of them, like subconsciously, they're like, hey, like, I don't want to die with nothing. Like, I don't want to have zero in my bank. So what happens is like this constant, like, you know, hey, am I spending too much of my portfolio? Even if they're well-funded, quote unquote, they're always concerned about, hey, I don't want to spend too much, and, you know, inflation and longevity. And so it kind of like the clients that I serve that have permanent life insurance, it's just like this freedom to just spend down the retirement assets more aggressively, knowing that they're not going to die with a $0 estate. They're going to have this life insurance policy, maybe real estate, maybe their business, et cetera. So I think it's just like, even if the primary goal isn't legacy, from what I've experienced and just talking with clients over the years, is like, it's still sometimes a secondary goal, and even a secondary goal can impact decisions you make for your primary objectives, which is spending.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, or the concern of long-term care, which is a totally different kind, you know, topic.
And just quick side note, people who are in their 60s or so and do decide they want insurance at this point, is term even realistically an option, or is it going to be prohibitively expensive? Plus, it's only going to last for whatever, 10 or 20 years, right? At that point, is it usually better to consider permanent insurance?
Well, it depends. You got to throw out it depends. I mean, I would say for someone who is 60 and wants a death benefit enforced when they're no longer here, you know, buying a term policy that's going to guarantee that, it's going to be tough to find, you know, because they have the actuary tables. You know, these life insurance companies have been around for a couple hundred years. Like, they know, like, if you're already 60, the likelihood of you living past their expiration date is pretty good. So they know 99% of term policies never pay a death claim, right? Only 1% of them do. So yeah. So if it's a short-term need, let's say it's like, hey, we have a mortgage that's still in force for 10 years, or hey, I have this pension that's, I want to make sure if I die early, you know, that military pension is replaced, or, you know what I mean? Like, maybe that's not as much of a risk when you're 85, but maybe at 60 or 65 it is. So maybe term could fit. Okay. But both products are still available. Once you get into your 70s, I don't even know if a lot of companies will write term insurance in your 70s. But permanent insurance, you can still purchase into your 70s. Once you hit 80, it becomes really difficult, really, really difficult to find a carrier that's going to want to give you a permanent life insurance policy.
Oh, really? Or if they do, it's got to be so expensive that you're probably fully paying for the death benefit anyway.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It becomes very cost prohibitive. And like, health changes, you know, over time. I obviously, like, you know, health concerns come up, and that's a big challenge for getting life insurance. you know, for my clients, let's say they're in their 60s, you know, they have a goal of, yeah, I want to present, like, this makes sense. Let's do a legacy for floor play, you know, but they've, you know, they were diagnosed with, you know, they had a stent put in, or, you know, that, you know, diabetes, whatever it might be, family history even, you know, continue. So underwriting is more of a challenge, obviously, the older you get. That's why I love, like, locking in a lot of term insurance when you're in your 30s and 40s and 50s that you could either keep as term or convert down the road, and you don't have to worry about that underwriting.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, comment or maybe some insight for other advisors listening. So you are fee only, you don't have insurance licenses anymore, but obviously clearly understand and appreciate insurance. What do you do when a client scenario comes up where, okay, I think this person could benefit from a certain type of insurance? Where do you go since you can't sell it yourself?
Yeah. So, you know, LLIS, that's a third party. All they do is insurance. They specialize in a lot of the low load and no load types of products out there. BC Brokerage, I'll go to them as well, just to get like multiple perspectives. And then I also have several contacts at some of the big mutuals, you know, because a lot of those carriers, they don't sell their products through these third-party vendors that are kind of the open architecture. They just sell them through their field force. And so I'll go to that field force and I'll say, hey, here's the situation. Let's run some illustrations to see, you know, how we can compare and contrast. And because that, different carriers have different types of the flavors of those particular products, particularly on the permanent insurance front. So like I try to get several opinions. And then what I do is I take those concepts and I'll talk to my client about that. You know, and I think that's a cool dynamic because like my client doesn't have to deal with the agent selling it. You know what I mean? They're not like, this guy's pushing me or this gal's pushing me to buy this product. Like they're already working with me and we're going to kind of dissect this together to see if it makes sense. Like the most recent scenario, you know, I got a bunch of different angles at it and basically I'm not even going to bring it to her attention because it's not better than what she currently has. You know what I mean? So that's I think a cool dynamic, and you probably experience that too with your practice.
Yeah, no, that's awesome what you just said. You as a third party did a bunch of looking around and analyzing for your client, realizing, you know what, none of these are really the right answer or better answer than what she has. Whereas if she worked with some other quote unquote advisors she found from, you know, Mahjong Club or God knows however else she found the person, chances are she probably would have walked away with a new product, right?
Yeah. I mean, listen, you got to give it to the insurance industry. They are great at training their sales force, and the arguments can sound very compelling to the average consumer. And oftentimes that leads for them to pull the trigger and buy the product. I think that's a big benefit, you know, for firms like ours is, you know, we can have that knowledge, but sort of like sift through the noise and tell them really how it works, you know? Because, you know, unfortunately, like even some of the age, like, when I first started in the industry, I didn't know anything about the products I was recommending. That's kind of the norm, you know, like, what I mean? And that's a little alarming. It's like products I was selling, I didn't understand all the mechanics, but you know, the higher ups there, the quote unquote mentors there said, this is the right thing to do. And so you just do it. And that's, I think why, a lot of people have that bad taste in their mouth because they may listen to like their friends starting in the industry or their son or daughter or their son's friend or, friend. And they buy these products just because they want to help them out. And now they're left with this product that doesn't fit in their plan. And I think there's a huge opportunity for firms like ours to help clients with the whole picture, including insurance, but not having to get compensated on what insurance they buy or how much they put into the policy. That's where it can get complicated for the client because it's like, is this really in my best interest or is this in the best interest of the agent selling me the product?
Right. Exactly. And just quick anecdotal story. So your comment about when you started, you really didn't know the product, yet you were told go sell this product and you were given the training and techniques necessary to, I don't want to say convince people to buy the product, but you know, to make that sale. That's part of why I've since gotten on my soapbox about insurance sales, specifically with the retiree crowd, because after hanging out in some Facebook groups, and other places where retiree folks hang out, I wouldn't be a talk about insurance if I didn't talk about Index Universal Life. So, and the sales process around it. It's one of the forms of permanent insurance most often structured and sold and marketed as a retirement income tool, as an investment-like vehicle, as tax-free income for life, as a can't-lose-money asset. And I've come across folks in forums and groups where I look them up, and here they are. They're pitching hot and heavy the same stale sales bites about why this life insurance retirement plan is the best thing since sliced bread. And no joke, Index Universal Life, which is at the core of these products, are one of the most complicated products there are of any product, not just insurance, but like any product, in my opinion. And so this person selling it, I looked him up. He had started 6 months prior. The 5 years prior to that, he was an amateur bodybuilder. For the 3 years prior to that, he worked at Petco. And I'm not knocking people in those, but like he is not the person to be understanding and selling this product, other than just give him the basic training, tell him what to say, and go schmooze people. Someone else, very similar story, started pitching these Index Universal Life as these fantastical panacea, cure all ailment retirement planning tools. Less than a year earlier, she was a manager of a fast food restaurant for a few years. Prior to that, she was working at a women's clothing store. Which again, this isn't to knock retail industry, but these people have zero background in financial products, especially something as complicated as this, where it takes a combination of like an actuary, an engineer, and a mathematician, and someone with a finance degree to figure them out. Here they are selling it to the masses, just given these really honed, really well thought out sales sound bites, and convincing a lot of people. And I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. It just, I know a lot of these aren't going to turn out well because these people, they're probably not going to be in the industry in a year, right? First of all. Anyway, that's my rant.
And real quick, I mean, with, the company I work for, I mean, people may look me up and kind of see what that company was. Like, the product isn't a bad product. Okay. It's a great product for the right person, and that, and it fits well in certain plans. Okay. What you're talking about, this, the IUL space, that's a totally different space. You know, I don't even know if the big mutuals do IUL.
They don't. No mutual insurer touches it.
That should tell you something right there. And I remember when I was coming up in the industry in 08, 09, like, this was talked about, because IUL didn't come about until 1997. Okay.
Yep.
So it's a new product. What's also a new product? Long-term care, and look what happened to long-term care in the 2010s. You know, like a lot of companies exited the business. They stopped selling products. That's my concern about this IUL pitch, is a lot of those sound bites, to your point, they sound amazing. Like rich person's Roth IRA or life insurance retirement plan or non-qualified, deferred comp plan. Like all of these like names and titles like sound really good, and tax-free. Like that's really what's pushed on these savings vehicles. But if you kind of really look under the hood at some of what's guaranteed, what's not guaranteed, what's in those illustrations, it's definitely alarming. And I guarantee the majority of agents selling the products could not tell you how those products actually work.
No, I'd agree with that. So, all right. With that said, maybe, I don't know, I think we did a good job talking about the basics of, at least life insurance, permanent versus term, when to consider, when not to. Can we maybe change gears a little bit, and to the extent you can sort of peel back the curtain, share your knowledge, experience for the benefit of those listening about insurance sales process, to the extent you give any tips to people, what to look out for, what to be aware of, whether it's, key terms to have your ear open to know you're getting pitched, or even how to do your diligence, like how to screen people, how to know the questions to ask, et cetera. An open slate, run.
Yeah. I mean, we could go a lot of different directions on that one. I would say, listen, I saw something, I think it was like a YouTube video or a TikTok video, where someone was like pitching the idea of, don't max your 401k plan. Like, only put in what the company is matching. Let's say it's 6%. Only put 6% in, okay, and put everything else into the IUL product, because this is the rich person's Roth. This is this infinite banking strategy. This is an overfunded, like, tax-free retirement account. Like that whole pitch, like that should be red flags all over the place, because you cannot compare apples to apples, a life insurance product as a savings vehicle, to a traditional 401k or Roth 401k or even a traditional brokerage account, because the cost structure is completely different. With that first strategy we mentioned, you're paying still for life insurance. And like, that's what people need to understand, is like, there are costs to owning life insurance. So unless we talked about, you have a need or want for permanent insurance that shouldn't be part of the discussion. Okay. If you have a need or want for permanent life insurance, then you could kind of look at this and say, hey, maybe I can also use this as an alternative asset class later on during lifetime. And there are some good strategies, I think, you know, where that makes sense. But the whole matching thing, like don't max your 401k and, you know, put it into this IUL or universal life policy or whole life policy. That's red flags all over the place. And that's not what I would be advice I would be following straight off the bat.
That's a great point. First and foremost, life insurance is life insurance. Not to say there's not ancillary benefits that could be very beneficial, but yeah, unless you have the want or need to insure your loss of life or to, you know, for your heirs to get a financial payout upon you passing, don't consider it. All these other bells and whistles are purely a secondary thing. And rightfully so, a cost comes with buying life insurance. There's no free lunch, nor should there be. Nope. So there will be costs you incur for owning life insurance that you wouldn't incur have you just used a traditional investment product like a brokerage account or 401k or whatever. Great point.
Absolutely. Or an annuity, right? I mean, you know, I think that's another thing. I was like, if you like the idea of like not paying taxes on your growth each year, which that's a big push for this, you know, for cash value life insurance, well, non-qualified annuities also have tax deferred growth and you can flip those, the switch on later and have some tax efficient income in retirement. Obviously not the same with death benefit, but if you don't have a need or want for permanent death benefit, you could absolutely look at having a term policy and having a variable annuity or having a term policy and have some sort of taxable brokerage account that you make very, very tax efficient, you know, as you've probably talked about on your show before. You know, another thing, you know, kind of, you know, throwing this out there, I've seen this example get thrown out a lot. Have you heard of the Jim Harbaugh, you know, story?
University of Michigan.
Michigan coach. And how like he has this, they have this huge life insurance policy as part of his contract, like as part of his compensation. And I've seen agents actually like pitch this online. They're like, hey, if this is good enough for Jim Harbaugh, like it's good enough for you too. Like this non-qualified deferred comp plan, this supplemental executive retirement plan. You're not Jim Harbaugh. So, there are reasons where a corporation may want to buy life insurance on a key employee. And that's another, you know, we're talking about solutions on how this fits. Absolutely. You know, corporate owned life insurance to fund a deferred comp plan that's like, you know, quote unquote unfunded, you know, to have some cash value in there to pay out at retirement, to have this death benefit to your key employee. I mean, those are great reasons to own it. But I think like this idea of like, hey, like, you know, Jim Harbaugh has this part as a retirement plan, you know, average retiree with $3 or $4 million in assets, you should too. Like that's also, you know, that's a little disingenuous there.
I've also heard lots of, and saw lots of people say the Rockefellers have lots of life insurance. You should too.
Right.
Are you saying I'm not the Rockefellers, Kevin?
Yeah. Hey, Andy, you know, one day, right? You know, so the Rockefeller Financial Services.
One can dream, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think there are, again, a lot of good reasons to own permanent life insurance. And those scenarios are more than likely for estate planning purposes, estate taxes, you know, over that estate, you know, that federal estate exemption. Like those are really good reasons to have permanent insurance. And, you know, but kind of leading, I think really what consumers need to look out for, if the person that's pitching the product is leading with the savings vehicle aspect, red flag, because it's life insurance first. If you're leading with savings, why are you using life insurance? Is there a permanent life insurance need? If not, why are we going to pay the cost of permanent life insurance as part of your savings vehicle? There's plenty of other areas that we can go and accumulate savings tax efficiently, you know, outside of life insurance.
Now, a question for you. That's a great point. Why is someone leading with the ancillary benefits, potential benefits of a life insurance product? Can someone who sells insurance, what's their like duty of care, standard of care? If the client doesn't have a legitimate need for life insurance, can they even sell the products? Are they even allowed to present the product first and foremost for its savings and investment-like features?
Yes. I mean, that's the unfortunate part is absolutely, it can be sold that way. If you put that in an email in writing that, hey, this is a savings vehicle for a lot of the big insurance companies that have a due diligence process of compliance, they will red flag that and they'll probably say, hey, is this product suitable or and why? Okay. So they follow that suitability standard, not the fiduciary standard, which is important for the consumer to know. You know, if your advisor sells both insurance and manages investments, they act as a fiduciary sometimes. You know, and I know you talked about that in one of your previous podcasts around that fiduciary standard of care. Insurance does not fall under that. So even if it's flagged by compliance, they could still say, hey, this is suitable and this is why. And suitability, I mean, come on. I mean, like anything could be relatively suitable. Like, you know what I mean? So, yeah, if it's led with savings, if the primary goal is an accumulation tool, I would want to get a second opinion on that. Not saying it's not the right solution. Okay. I'm not saying that at all. There are plenty of solutions where I'm like, hey, this could be a nice little alternative savings vehicle to complement other things that they're doing, like maxing 401ks and doing backdoor conversions, or, you know, funding an HSA or a taxable brokerage account. This could be part of that picture. But if it's led with savings, I would also want to figure out, like, how is this policy designed? Because, like, the scary kind of like truth around the insurance is, like, the illustrations that are run by the agent, you know, it will show what the commission is for the agent. And so that's not given to the client. It's just the agent sees it. And, you know, are they designing the policy properly if their commission goes, you know, from, you know, let's say 10,000 to 20,000, you know, because you're putting the same premiums in, but the commissions can be way more than really what you need to pay if it's what I like to call properly designed and properly funded.
And
so those are just a few things there.
Yeah, cool. Not to scare people, but with regards to properly designed, properly funded, I've spent a few-year journey trying to figure out specifically Index Universal Life, again, because they're sold to retirees as tax-free retirement accounts, life insurance retirement plans, laser fund, private reserve accounts, Section 7702 plans. And so I bought one myself. I think most people listening know that, largely as an experiment. I mean, it is life insurance. If it's technically on my wife, you know, if she dies, I get the death benefit from it. So it is that. But I found someone that I believe to be one of the sharper, more thorough, really knows his stuff agents out there to help me structure this. And I made it all freely available to the world. There's a website, not pitch it for the sake of pitching it, but theiulexperiment.com, where I have the entire set of policy documents, the illustrations, the policy itself, all the supporting material. And when I made it public, no joke, close to 10 other agents reached out either publicly or through private message and said, that policy could have been designed better. Here's how I would have done it. Right. And those 10 different ways weren't the same. Yeah. Everyone who claims to be an expert and knowing how to best structure these had different opinions, I'll call them, about what could have or should have been done better. So how's the average consumer, like, I threw my hands up, like, forget it. Like, all these people claiming to be the preeminent sources of knowledge on this all have differing opinions. Is there actually the best way to structure and fund these? My takeaway is no. But anyway, I don't know. I'm just saying that. So, like, how are consumers supposed to know when someone claims to say this is the best policy structured and funded the best way? Is it really? You're never going to know.
Well, that's a great point. Well, I mean, let me ask you this, Anna. Like, you know, it sounds like you had this illustration, like the one you actually move forward with and purchase. Like, looking at the other ones, I mean, you were probably like, how lost were you looking through all those contracts? And like, you know what I mean? Like, was it anything more clear or was it less clear for you?
My takeaway was they're all using different assumptions. Yep. And illustrations are nothing more than a complicated multi-decade series of assumptions. Yep. And so sure, if you were to fund this policy over the course of 10 years instead of 7 years, using these assumptions built into this illustration modeling tool, yes, it could potentially turn out better.
Yeah.
There's no guarantees.
I think you nailed it, right? I mean, I think with traditional whole life insurance or permanent insurance, the product that's been around for over a century, there are a lot of guarantees in there that are built into the contract. There are, of course, non-guarantee elements too, a non-guarantee dividend rate, their current mortality and expense charges. But like, if you work with a big mutual company that's been doing this for over a century, they know what their pricing needs to be, so they can illustrate the current assumptions. Universal life policies can do what's called a backwards look, and they can look at, hey, what have we done in the past, and we'll illustrate that going forward. But knowing that they can change those things at any time. Like, for example, indexed universal life, they can change that cap rate at any point. So if you're seeing a 9% cap rate on your S&P 500, you know, you think, hey, I'm going to get the return or 0%. Well, they can change that cap rate if things get tough. You know, they could also change or in addition to that, the 0% floor. I think a lot of people think, hey, well, the 0% floor, I can never lose money. You still have to pay cost of insurance.
Right.
You know, so even though you have a 0% return on your dividend was zero, you're going to have expense charges that are going to actually make your cash values go down. And I think the illustration to your point, Andy, is the big part of why these products have gained so much traction since the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but also why there's a more than double the lapse rate relative to other whole life, traditional whole life products, is because they don't turn out the way the illustration said it was going to turn out.
Right.
You know, I mean, how many times have we like looked at a universal policy that was written in the 90s or the 80s and it wasn't properly funded, but it was based on those assumptions back then of what the interest rates were going to be, not knowing that we were going to have literally more than a decade of next to nothing, next to 0% interest rates, and insurance companies are feeling that pain. And so now those illustrations, you run a new in-force policy and it's like, oh, hey, by the way, yeah, this is permanent, but if you don't put an extra, you know, $20,000 of premiums in this year, this policy is going to lapse, you know? And I think that's a big reason why, even if you buy these policies, every year as part of your review process, get the new updated illustration, the in-force illustration. It'll have the new expense charges, the new mortality, the new dividend rate, you know, embedded in there.
Which makes it a lot of work. And not saying that's a reason alone to not get these things, but life insurance policies, especially in one of the universal flavors of life insurance, are definitely not set and forget it things.
Nope.
Fortunately. So.
No, for sure.
Okay.
But I'm excited to hear, see how your experiment goes. I remember, you know, seeing you posting about that. So has it been a year yet or not yet?
No, not until December. So there's really no update to give until December. My first interest crediting segment will hit its 1 year mark. And I'm not to get too technical, but staggered. I had three different options I use crediting segments, a 1 year, a 2 year, and a 3 year. We'll know in December how things are turning out so far.
Yeah. And I think that's a cool experiment. And I think there's a lot of folks out there that probably have some permanent life insurance policies they're really happy they bought them. And probably a lot of people that are maybe regretting buying them. And I think, again, it goes back to how it fits in each person's plan. But I think, you know, with some of the introductions of these newer policies, and I'll call universal life a newer policy. I mean, that, you know, I don't think those came around until the 80s, right? You know, when interest rates skyrocketed and, you know, traditional whole life wasn't super attractive. So, you know, they kind of put these, you know, universal life policies out there to allow for higher crediting rates and kind of max funding. But then they got abused and people would essentially buy no life insurance and just stuff a bunch of cash in there. And I think kind of like the smell test around like, how do you know if it's properly designed, is looking at like, hey, like what is the maximum funding to not become a modified endowment contract? I think that's like a starting point to kind of look at if you're using this as an asset class, is to see, hey, like what is the maximum you can put into a life insurance policy so you can avoid it becoming a MEC if it is indeed a savings vehicle for you. And for the listeners that don't know what a MEC is, a modified endowment contract, it essentially loses a lot of the tax benefits on the cash values that otherwise would be enjoyed by a traditional non-MEC policy. You know, so if it's a policy that it's designed just to pay one-time lump sum, most likely that's some kind of modified endowment contract or a MEC, and you're not going to have as tax efficient access to the cash value. But the 7-pay test allows you to kind of see what's the maximum you can put in to the policy relative to a certain death benefit that you want to own for life. And that's a really good starting point to see like, hey, is this policy properly funded? You know?
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And sorry about that, the little IUL sidetrack that anytime insurance comes up, this usually comes out of my mouth in one way, shape, or form. Other words of wisdom for consumers. So you mentioned anytime someone sells insurance by leading with the investment or savings component, that's a red flag. Not saying don't buy a policy because of it, but it at least should heighten your awareness and diligence.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I'll just kind of point out is like, I've seen a lot of illustrations out there run with an internal rate of return calculation on the illustration. I've also seen like separate columns where they'll run a tax equivalent IRR Just kind of take that with a grain of salt. Like, this is going to, like, and I've seen them run upwards of 50%, by the way, which is like, is their highest marginal rate at 50 or is it lower than that? You know, so I think you need to apply your own tax rate to it, but your own situation. But if you're looking at it as a savings vehicle, you know, I think that's a little bit disingenuous to say, well, the alternative would just be to put it in a CD and just earn interest income on that alternative asset class. So I would just kind of say, like, take that with a grain of salt, maybe use the IRR calculator without the tax equivalent first, just to have a starting point, and then run and if you're going to show the tax equivalent, just make it apples to apples. You know, maybe look at, you know, sort of a combination of marginal interest, you know, marginal tax bracket versus capital gains. I think that's a fair, some sort of blend of those two. Because I, you know, it obviously looks amazing if you're assuming a 50% tax equivalent yield. Like, yeah, it's going to look like the life insurance cash value is outperforming the S&P 500 over the last 30 to 40 years. So of course it's going to look great, but just kind of be careful with that type of trick there. But I don't know.
Cool. This was all super helpful. Hope everyone listening, you know, regular folk, consumers and advisors alike, have picked up a little something from Kevin's knowledge here. Yeah. Anything else you'd add? Final words of wisdom?
Well, I think, you know, if we're going to, you know, sort of like end on like the savings vehicle, you know, concept, I am personally, I'll just maybe like share, like, I am biased more towards traditional permanent insurance and having that policy as part of a long-term strategy, just because, like, you know, universal life hasn't been around for that long, and the companies that are doing it, they haven't really been doing it for that long, whereas the kind of the big mutuals have. But I think really where this can work well for retirees is as a fixed income alternative. Okay. And, you know, you kind of look at what bonds did in 2022. You know, the 60-40 portfolio wasn't pretty, you know, like we all experienced that with our practice and our clients that are probably close to retirement. They probably have a healthy dose of bonds in their portfolio. What I like about a traditional portfolio-based life insurance contract is the cash values can never go backwards, you know, whereas bonds, they can fluctuate based on what interest rates do. And if you have a policy that's a non-MEC and you kind of have that throughout retirement, and, you know, knowing that the primary goal, again, is the life insurance death benefit, and you pay that cost of insurance, you can kind of look at that cash value as an asset on your balance sheet as a just in case the market drops or just in case bonds go through another 2022. And it can kind of give people a little bit more flexibility on how aggressive they are with their IRA or 401k or their traditional investment accounts, you know, knowing that they have a little bit of that downside protection in a fixed income alternative. Because at the end of the day, the insurance companies are investing everyone's premiums in a lot of fixed income types of instruments. But the difference is they pay the dividend rate on the cash value. The client doesn't own the bond. So even if those are fluctuating in value, the client is not going to experience that. And I think that's a really powerful thing to go through retirement. Again, if you have a death benefit focus, but the cash value could be a nice secondary use for that fixed income alternative you know, strategy. So for whatever that's worth, I think that's a really good way to position the cash component or the equity component of life insurance policies as that bond alternative.
Now, and when you say view it as an asset, do you mean, because I know, like you said, like in a traditional whole life policy, the cash value won't decline. But do you mean you view it as an asset because you can use that cash value either through loans against it or outright surrender, you know, partial surrenders or distributions?
Loans or surrenders, absolutely. And so, okay, you know, let's say a retiree 2022, you know, would looking to take 100,000 of distributions, right? And, you know, they see their bond portfolio is down 12%, their equities are down close to 20%. You know, most people have probably heard the notion you don't want to be selling when the market's down. And I know there are other ways to protect against that, whether it's an individual bond ladder or, you know, have some cash on hand. But the life insurance could be a supplemental vehicle to tap into, like to your point, with either policy loans or, you know, partial surrenders to fill that income need while the market does recover, you know, so you can kind of preserve those investments when the market does come back. And then the flexibility of putting that cash back in there and continuing that process throughout retirement, you know, because a retiree may on average go through 4 or 5 bear markets during a 30-year retirement. So it's nice to have that in your back pocket. Again, if the permanent life insurance component fits into your plan, that's the key.
Right. Exactly. You start with that, right? Buying this to be this alternative asset. I'm buying it for life insurance because there's costs associated on that. Yep. Pay those costs, et cetera. Yeah. Okay.
And it takes a long time to recoup those costs. You know, a lot of the policies that are designed like the traditional whole life policies, you may not even break even for the first 12 or 13 years. You know, you're going to be cash negative. And so again, that's the argument against this thing. If you don't have a permanent death benefit need, why are you going to wait that long for your cash value to break even, you know, and pay all of those upfront costs, whether it's commissions or sales charges or cost of life insurance? But if you have those needs or desires throughout retirement, then you can look at the cash value as a nice supplement to what you're doing elsewhere.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. Awesome. Kevin, thank you. This was incredibly helpful. So you're a sharp cat. I like you. Thanks for your sharing your time and knowledge here. Tell us a little more how people can find you. Your company name again, Imagine Financial Security.
Yeah, I would say my website is probably a good place to start. ImagineFinancialSecurity.com is the website. You know, we put out some blogs, some podcasts as well. And we're retirement focused firm, you know, based here in Northeast Florida, Jacksonville, St. Augustine, and mostly serve folks here in Florida, but also some folks, you know, around in New York or, you know, other states that are looking to move to Florida. So we get a lot of those. And
can you work with people throughout other states and just generally don't, or you kind of?
Yeah, we have probably clients in, I think maybe six states right now, six different states. And that is growing. You know, I do have people reaching out to me from random places, you know, finding me online and whatnot. So that is growing. And with technology these days, we can serve those folks regardless of where they live.
Yeah. And I know you got a podcast as well.
Yep. The Planning for Retirement podcast.
Okay. And I'll be sure to put
might have to do a life insurance podcast after this one. You know, just there you like go. Follow, yeah. You know what I mean? Because there's so much to unpack. And like, honestly, we probably just scratched the surface on some of this stuff. And there's a lot more to learn and to like kind of dive into. But I think the average consumer, hopefully listening to this, will have a good starting point on how they need to evaluate these things and how it fits or doesn't fit into their financial plan.
Yeah. Cool. I'll be sure to put links to both your firm site and podcast in the notes to this episode. So
cool.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. Pleasure. And I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.